Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. A court decision means the people of Greece will vote on their financial future this weekend. The Council of State, Greece's highest administrative court, has rejected an appeal by two citizens asking for Greece's critical referendum on austerity to be ruled unconstitutional. The vote will be held as planned Sunday. The two men had appealed to the court on the grounds that Greece's constitution bars popular votes on fiscal issues. The voters are being asked whether to accept creditors' demands for more austerity in return for bailout loans. Zlatika Hope has more.
Prime Minister Tsipras on Thursday appealed to Greek national pride as he urged voters to reject the conditions of an international bailout.
Despite the fact that we are in unprecedented economic difficulty, we must keep the core of our sovereignty. We will decide how to distribute the funds. We will decide where to make cuts. We will decide if and how we will maintain the combat effectiveness of our armed forces.
Many Greeks are critical of the proposed bailout deal, but not enough to want to leave the eurozone. The government has offered some last-minute concessions, but Europe's finance chiefs have refused any more negotiations before Sunday's vote. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Friday with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Vienna to discuss key disputes that prevented nuclear negotiators from meeting a June 30th deadline for an agreement. Kerry said the talks followed an earlier brief discussion with Zarif on Friday. The discussions come after the IAEA Director General visited Tehran. This is VOA News. Witnesses say Boko Haram militants have executed 11 members who were accused of deserting the Islamist extremist group. Residents of Moringa, a town in Nigeria's Borno state, say Boko Haram fighters entered their town before dawn Friday and went house to house looking for alleged defectors. A Nigerian newspaper reports the militants killed the 11 by slitting their throats. Boko Haram is blamed for several attacks this week and the deadliest wave of violence since President Muhammadu Buhari took office May 29th. Wednesday, suspected militants massacred 97 people in the town of Kakawa near Lake Chad. On Tuesday, militants shot dead 48 people near the town of Manguno. The head of the United Nations Cultural Organization says the loss of ancient artifacts destroyed by militants in Iraq and Syria has long-term implications for security and peace in the region. The official spoke in London. VOA's Al Pessin has more.
The group considers the statues and sculptures blasphemous because they're not in keeping with Islamic tradition. The resulting outcry by archaeologists and other experts received some criticism from people who said the loss of plaster and stone cannot compare to the tens of thousands of deaths and injuries in the conflict. But at London's Chatham House, UNESCO Director General Irina Bukova said the concern is about much more than stones and artwork.
Safeguarding cultural heritage is a security imperative and a peace-building measure.
UNESCO says many of the cultural relics that are not being destroyed are being sold illegally to finance more militant operations. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
A solar-powered Swiss airplane touched down in Hawaii at 6 o'clock local time Friday, completing a record-breaking flight across the Pacific Ocean, the riskiest leg of its 35,000-kilometer trip around the world without a drop of fuel. Solar Impulse 2. The pilot, Andre Borschberg, has now beaten the previous longest solo piloting record that was held by American adventurer Steve Fawcett. Borschberg took 20-minute naps during the journey in the unpressurized cockpit while the aircraft was on autopilot. SI-2 took off from Nagoya, Japan early Monday after an unscheduled month-long stop. The aircraft was diverted to Nagoya because of bad weather at the beginning of June on its trip from Nanjing in eastern China to Hawaii. Swiss adventurer Bertrand Piccard will fly the same aircraft on the next leg from Hawaii to the city of Phoenix, Arizona. From there, Solar Impulse is scheduled to fly to New York before crossing the Atlantic.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
United Nations aid agencies report the delivery of urgently needed humanitarian aid to millions of desperate people in Yemen is being hampered by the escalating war. The agencies say only a fraction of the more than 21 million people needing aid throughout the country are receiving it.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, the UN Electoral Observer team at Burundi's parliament election last Monday says the process was not conducive to a free and fair vote. And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has taken steps towards reforming the country's vital oil sector. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the UN Electoral Observer team at Burundi's parliament election last Monday says the process was not conducive to a free and fair vote. Spokesman Farhan Haq says today the UN team observed violence and explosions in Bujumbura, the capital. Before and during the vote, they also reported press restrictions, arbitrary arrests and extrajudicial killings by armed youth groups linked to political parties. The U.S. State Department has called for a delay in further voting and today suspended training of Burundi military officers and threatened to deny the government trade preferences of the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Monday's parliamentary vote may be a prelude to the June 15th election in which President Pierre Nkurunziza seeks a third term in office. Opposition parties have protested his candidacy as a violation of the Constitution and have boycotted the election process. More than 70 deaths have been reported in 3 months of protests, and more than 140,000 have fled the country. The results of Monday's vote have not yet been announced, and despite increasing international pressure, Mr. Nkurunziza shows no sign of calling off his campaign for the presidency. The New York Times reports the U.S. Defense Department has confirmed a mid-June airstrike in Libya killed the leader of Ansar al-Sharia. Sifala Ben Hassin was head of the Tunisian terrorist group linked to al-Qaeda, the U.S. military source says. Since 2013, Ben Hassini has been operating training camps and a network of militant cells across the region. The official said Ben Hassini has been identified by DNA from an airstrike by U.S. Air Force F-15 jets last month that targeted Mokhtar Belmokhtar, the Algerian leader of al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. News of Ben Hassini's death was first reported by the Tunisian station radio Mosaic and confirmed by a senior American official in Washington, where DNA tests were being conducted. Tunisia has been a major source of jihadists in recent years. Observers estimate as many as 3,000 have been recruited to al-Qaeda and the Islamist State in Iraq. Tunisia's successful transition to a democratic state is being challenged by recent terrorist attacks, like the shooting of 21 tourists in Tunis's famed Bardo Museum earlier this year and the mass shooting last week of 39 tourists at a Tunisian beach resort. United Nations aid agencies report the delivery of urgently needed humanitarian aid to millions of desperate people in Yemen is being hampered by the escalating war. The agencies say only a fraction of the more than 21 million people needing aid throughout the country are receiving it. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
On July 1st, airstrikes and mortars damaged two offices of the International Organization for Migration in Herat and Basatin in the Aden Governorate. No one was killed or wounded, but these attacks highlight the dangers encountered by aid workers in Yemen. UN High Commissioner for Refugees spokesman Adrian Edwards says UNHCR and its partners have been able to deliver non-food aid to just over 84,000 displaced people since the start of April, shortly after Saudi Arabia began its bombing campaign against Houthi rebels.
Yemen's aid situation remains extraordinarily difficult. The distributions have come amid a worsening situation in many governorates. Al-Hazm, the capital of Al-Jawf governorate in the country's north, was hit by airstrikes over three consecutive days in late June. This caused the evacuation of some at least 900 families from one of the districts of the city.
The World Food Programme agrees that limited access due to constant insecurity remains a fundamental obstacle to the effective delivery of food throughout the country. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says the situation is particularly dire in Yemen's principal port city of Aden.
WFP has attempted several times to reach Aden with ships, but the insecurities around the port force ships to turn back. However, we are still trying by land and, of course, by sea.
Beer says WFP has succeeded in distributing food for 80,000 people in June. Still, she notes, Aden has a population of 1 million, so this has barely made a dent in the huge needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
European countries are looking for a new way to hold off the growing flood of migrants from the Middle East and Africa who are escaping poverty, violence, and political repression. France and England are pooling financial resources to beef up security at the French port of Calais. More than 3,000 migrants are now camped in the French port. Many are trying to reach England by boarding ferries crossing the English Channel or boarding trucks as they enter the Channel Tunnel. Hungary has proposed a 13-foot-tall, 109-mile-long fence to block further migrant entries. The UN Refugee Agency has publicly cautioned that Hungary's parliamentarians may be creating fatal consequences for migrants. An open letter from the UN Refugee Agency's regional representative that was published in Budapest cautions against building a fence at Serbia's border. Serbia expressed shock at the proposal in Budapest. Hungary's parliament is also considering fast-track approval of an interior ministry proposal to prolong periods of detention for migrants seeking asylum. More than 100,000 migrants have entered Hungary in the last 12 months. Nigerian security officials in Maiduguri, a major target of recent attacks by a resurgent Boko Haram, say 13 civilians were killed by two female suicide bombers today. Also today, another 10 civilians died in a series of bombings targeting fruit vendors along Borno State roads leading to Maiduguri. The week's death toll has risen to more than 160 in Nigeria's northwest as a largely Muslim population celebrate the holy month of Ramadan. An estimated 100 worshippers were gunned down Tuesday when militants targeted several mosques in Kukwa town. In Chad's capital of N'Djamena, prosecutors say today they have discovered a large supply of weapons hidden in the home of Bana Fanaye. Officials arrested Fanaye on Tuesday and identified him as Boko Haram's logistics chief for northern Cameroon and Chad. They say he was a major supplier of weapons destined for Nigeria. And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari took a step towards reforming the country's vital oil sector last month by firing the board of the state oil company. Chris Stein reports on how this demonstrates the new president's plans for managing Nigeria's biggest industry.
On the campaign trail, Mr. Buhari vowed to stamp out corruption in Nigeria. If he is going to do that, analysts say, he needs to reform the state-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC, which has long been dogged by allegations of waste and graft. Mr. Buhari showed his hand late last month by firing the NNPC's board. Dolapo Oni, head of energy research at Ecobank, says that move effectively puts him in control of the company.
I think he has direct access to information from within the system and possibly can also, to some extent, micromanage the administration of the NNPC himself.
Oil is the economic backbone of Nigeria, Africa's largest economy. But the petroleum prosperity has been so poorly distributed that only a rich elite benefit from it, while millions live in poverty. Cleaning up the NNPC has long been seen as crucial to fixing this disparity. The former central bank governor, Lamido Sanusi, for instance, said in 2013 that the NNPC had not handed over billions of dollars in oil money it owed the government. He was fired after making the allegation. There are risks and rewards to President Buhari's firing of the NNPC board, says Yvonne Mohango, sub-Saharan Africa economist at Renaissance Capital. Reforming the NNPC may ultimately help Nigeria boost oil production and cut graft, she says. Without a governing board or a petroleum minister to oversee it, however, the NNPC is at risk of being leaderless.
For one, it brings around policy paralysis, because now it's a sit and wait mode. And secondly, a shake-up of any industry would, of course, have some downside risks.
Appointments for petroleum minister and other cabinet postings are not expected until September. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Sixteen past the hour. You will listen to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. As Liberia rebuilds a healthcare system severely damaged by the Ebola outbreak, researchers say the nation must provide better medical services in remote rural areas. A report examining barriers to healthcare was published in the online Journal of Global Health. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Liberia was declared Ebola-free on May 9th. But several new cases of late show just how tenuous that label can be. The first new case since May 9th was a 17-year-old boy who died the last weekend in June. John Kramer has studied how Liberia dealt with the epidemic. He says while health officials are acting quickly, the fact that new infections were found is heartbreaking.
The last time I was in Liberia was in February. The cases were essentially gone. And there was this sort of palpable optimism every place. And so it's really disheartening to see these cases back. It does appear that the ministry and their partners are on top of things, which is at least optimistic. Certainly the system is fragile. What these cases indicate is hard to know, but it's concerning that the young man who died doesn't appear to have been on anybody's list of contacts.
The Liberian teenager reportedly had been identified as having malaria, not Ebola. Kramer is an associate professor of health systems administration at Georgetown University. He's also a technical consultant to the organization Last Mile Health, which focuses on rural health care.
Before Ebola, Liberia was coming out of the war which ended in 2003, and health indicators were really turning around. And so the progress that you saw in things like under five mortality or maternal health indicators was really impressive. Given how little money there is in the system, given how few physicians, other healthcare providers there were in the country, Ebola, to some extent, just decimated that system.
He says it's too soon to tell what the long-term impact of the Ebola epidemic will be on Liberia's healthcare system. But he says with the loss of many health workers to Ebola also came a loss of trust in the system. Medical care is more available in urban areas than rural. So Kramer and Last Mile Health looked at how the rural population copes.
This is a population that's as disadvantaged as any place on the planet. And so we really wanted to understand what particular barriers this population faces in order to be able to deliver services as well as possible.
Kramer says the main finding of the research is not surprising.
Of course, as you get farther away from health facilities, access to care declines, and it declines fairly drastically. So, for example, one measure that we use is what we call the full maternal health cascade, which is at least four antenatal care visits, facility-based delivery, and postnatal care for the mother and child. And when we look at this measure among people who live in the most distant parts, the most remote parts of this rural population, only about 7% or so receive that full cascade.
That's 75% less for those remote rural populations compared to rural populations closer to urban areas. The distance between those two rural groups may be just 11 to 40 kilometers.
The same thing is true for childhood illnesses. If you looked at fever treatment, we saw about 9% of kids, the most distant group, getting care for fever, potential malaria, compared to 43% the nearest but still rural group.
But Kramer says no matter what the distance, parents want their children to receive care for illnesses.
If you sort of step back a level and you ask parents, when your child had fever, when your child had acute respiratory illness, potential pneumonia, did they receive care from anybody? Distance didn't matter in the answer to that question. And that's also, of course, not surprising, right? So parents want their kids to be treated, and parents would seek care from somebody no matter where they were. But parents who lived in the most rural parts of this rural area would be much more likely to get their kids treated by a traditional provider, by these providers called black baggers, which are sort of roving medicine dispensaries.
He says the quality of care could be much lower in such cases.
You don't know what the drugs are. You don't know if the drugs are expired or ever had active ingredients. You don't really have diagnostic capabilities. And so the optimistic part of that, I think, is that it suggests that there's real demand for healthcare services that can be met if you can get services out to where people actually live.
He says with today's technology, groups like Last Mile Health can provide diagnostic and treatment for malaria, acute respiratory infections, and severe diarrhea, and help with family planning, among other things.
The thing that's really complicated but is really, really important is referral networks. A woman goes into labor, she needs to figure out a way to get transported to a facility to be able to deliver in a facility. In the U.S., that would be done by an ambulance, or a friend would drive the person. Here, you have to become a lot more creative. So it's thinking about engaging people who already drive from community to community because they're delivering things. It's amazing to me that this happens, but finding people who are motorbiking, small-level supplies, who can literally put a woman in delivery on the back of the motorbike. I've never been in labor, but I can't imagine that's much fun.
To improve medical care in remote rural areas of Liberia, Kramer and his colleagues have these recommendations. Community health worker-based service delivery, partnership with traditional care providers, mobile clinics, providing transportation costs, and reimbursing families for seeking health care. Kramer is also a scholar with the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University. He says international human rights law and ethical norms oblige health ministries and their development partners to promote equal access to essential health services. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The United States has condemned in the strongest possible terms yesterday's ambush on a convoy of UN peacekeepers in Mali, in which 6 people were killed and 5 more were wounded. The attack took place on a road about 45 kilometers southwest of the city of Timbuktu in Mali's restive northern desert. The extremist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has claimed responsibility for the ambush. In a statement late yesterday, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, expressed condolences to the families of the 6 victims, all from Burkina Faso, and to the Burkina Faso government. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon vowed that the attack will not alter the UN's determination to support the Malian people and efforts to restore peace. And members of the UN Security Council noted that attacks targeting peacekeepers may constitute war crimes under international law. Amnesty International says abuses committed in the Republic of Congo during last year's deportation of tens of thousands to the Democratic Republic of Congo could amount to crimes against humanity. For VOA, Nick Long in the DRC has more.
In a report published Thursday, Amnesty describes a range of human rights violations allegedly committed by Congo-Brazzaville's security forces between April and September of last year during mass expulsions of DRC nationals. The organization says at least 179,000 DRC citizens were expelled at that time from the neighboring country, and that the deportations have continued this year. Congo-Brazzaville has said previously that the DRC nationals are illegal foreign workers. Amnesty's report on this police operation is named Mbate Yabakolo, which means slap of the elders in the Congolese language, Lingala. It documents reports of arbitrary arrests, extortion and theft, rapes and fatalities. Some of these crimes were allegedly committed by Congo-Brazzaville police. Amnesty International researcher Evie Frank told VOA about testimony she heard from a deportee.
She says a woman who was a street vendor told her that one day police came and stole $300 from her and her merchandise. When she and four of her colleagues fled, the police chased them and they were raped one after the other. When the women tried to get to a hospital, they were denied access, says Frank. The report documents several similar cases. The operation was initially launched in response to crimes committed by gang members from Kinshasa who had fled to Brazil to escape a police crackdown in the DRC. But Amnesty says it was soon extended to any DRC citizens, and police used radio to broadcast appeals to the public to denounce so-called criminal households, while recording artists composed songs openly inciting discrimination against foreigners. Landlords were fined $600 for so-called illegal households, according to the report. Video footage of abuses in Brazil has been widely seen in the DRC. The footage includes scenes where women were surrounded by men who kicked and punched them and then pulled off their clothes. Evie Frank tells VOA that Amnesty interviewed 110 people who were victims of the operation, and more than 50% said they were victims of arbitrary arrest. She says the mass expulsions without due process and forcible returns of refugees and asylum seekers were in contravention of international law. A number of people were reportedly killed during the expulsions, Frank said, although she could not give a death toll. She spoke to one man who lost his wife as they were being pushed onto a ferry to take them across the Congo River to Kinshasa. She says he told her that as they were putting their belongings on the boat, his wife was pushed into the water by a policeman and she drowned in front of him. He was never able to recover his wife's body, she says. Amnesty has called on the Republic of Congo to bring to justice those suspected of crimes, including possibly crimes against humanity, committed during the operation. Nick Long for VOA, Goma.
And researchers are inching closer towards the development of a treatment and cure for dengue fever caused by a mosquito-borne virus that infects millions of people every year in the tropics. Investigators have found a protein or monoclonal antibody that zaps one of four types of dengue. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
There are four so-called serotypes of dengue fever, which infects an estimated 400 million people each year. The disease causes severe flu-like symptoms. In severe cases caused by repeated infection, the disease can be fatal. In a study published in the journal Science, researchers in the U.S. and Singapore described the discovery of a potent human antibody that neutralizes dengue type 2, an aggressive version of the virus. The monoclonal antibody was discovered in the blood of patients stricken with dengue. James Crowe is director of the Vaccine Center at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee. Crowe, a study co-author, says the monoclonal antibody stops infection in humans at the cellular level.
The virus injects its own genes into the cell to make more of itself, and this antibody actually staples the virus closed so that it can't do that injecting of its own genes into cells.
In experiments with mice, the human monoclonal antibody easily killed dengue serotype 2. Crowe believes the discovery will lead to a drug to treat all four types of dengue fever.
We believe that it's possible to find similar antibodies for the other serotypes. So if we actually move forward for developing a therapeutic for humans, this will probably be a mixture or cocktail of four antibodies, and this would be one of the antibodies, which corresponds to one of the four viruses.
Crowe says researchers are in talks with a number of drug companies interested in using the discovery to develop a cure for dengue fever. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Electoral Observers team at Burundi's parliamentary election last Monday says the process was not conducive to a free and fair vote. The U.S. Defense Department has confirmed the mid-June airstrike in Libya killed the head of the Tunisian terrorist group linked to Al-Qaeda. And the Nigerian security officials in Maiduguri say 13 civilians were killed by two female suicide bombers today. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, a disturbing pattern of extrajudicial killings by Kenyan police. I'm Yehiz Wuhim, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz.
I understand you're kicking off with Women's World Cup.
Yehiz, let's kick off in Vancouver, Canada, where the 7th Women's World Cup football final will be played Sunday. It'll be a rematch of the 2011 final between the United States and reigning champion Japan. 4 years ago in Germany, the Japanese beat the USA 3-1 on penalty kicks after the teams drew 2-2 during regulation and extra time. Tickets for Sunday's final are officially sold out. About 54,000 fans will pack BC Place Stadium in Vancouver. And as for overall attendance at the month-long tournament, I think officials at FIFA, World Football's governing body, are pleased. In addition to Vancouver, the Canadian cities of Edmonton, Winnipeg, Ottawa, Moncton, and Montreal have staged matches. Here in the United States, television viewership of matches has been very good, with many fans following the World Cup campaign of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. Almost 8.5 million viewers watched Tuesday's semifinal between the USA and Germany from Montreal's Olympic Stadium, the highest figure to date for this tournament. It was also the third largest U.S. TV audience in Women's World Cup history, trailing the 1999 final with almost 20 million viewers and the 2011 final with about 13.5 million viewers. Fans watching this year's tournament have seen a USA team with a rock-solid defense. The American women have given up only one goal, and that came in the team's opening match, a 3-1 victory over Australia. Hope Solo has kept the USA goal safe for 523 consecutive minutes. She says physically, the USA wants to be ready for the Japanese.
Yeah, you know, by the time our bodies are feeling up to par again, 100%, it's game time. So in the next couple of days, we'll be recovering. We'll be traveling back to Vancouver, a 5.5-hour flight. Doing a couple yoga sessions, doing some ice baths, doing everything we can to be 100% for the final.
That's Hope Solo, the USA's goalkeeper, who has posted 5 consecutive shutouts at the Women's World Cup. Midfielder Carly Lloyd has been wearing the captain's armband for the USA, and she's been wearing it with distinction. After hitting the 200 mark for international appearances for the American team, Carly was named player of the match in the USA's 2-0 semifinal victory over Germany. She scored the first goal off a penalty kick and set up the second by teammate Kelly O'Hara. Captain Carly Lloyd echoes Hope Solo's comments about being physically ready for the Japanese.
It's just about recovering, you know, doing all the right things off the field, getting our bodies back healthy, strong. We've got an extra day compared to the, you know, the other semifinal game.
That's Carly Lloyd, the captain of the USA's Women's World Cup team, which will play reigning champion Japan Sunday in the final in Vancouver, Canada. Meanwhile, Carly Lloyd and Hope Solo, who we heard from earlier, are both on short lists for 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup awards. Solo is one of three candidates for the Adidas Golden Glove Award given to the top goalkeeper, along with Nadine Anger of Germany and Ayumi Kaiori of Japan. Meanwhile, Carly Lloyd is one of three American players on the short list for the Adidas Golden Ball Award given to the best player of the tournament. Americans Megan Rapinoe and Julie Johnston are also on the short list, as well as Aya Miyama and Sayori Ariyoshi, both from Japan, Lucy Bronze from England, Amandine Henri from France, and Celia Sasic from Germany. The 27-year-old Sasic is the top scorer at the Women's World Cup with 6 goals. FIFA will announce the winners of the various awards after Sunday's final between the USA and Japan.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.
The voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the voice of America. The president and other Americans will on Saturday celebrate the annual 4th of July holiday, marking the USA's 239th Independence Day. Joining us now from Johannesburg with more sports news is Mark Ouma.
We begin with volleyball. Kenya play Mexico and hosts Algeria engage Australia at the Women's World Volleyball Grand Prix in Algiers today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Kenya play Australia as Algeria face Mexico. On Sunday, Australia engage Mexico as Algeria challenge Kenya. In basketball, Egypt play Tunisia in a classification tie at the Men's World Under-19 Basketball Championships in Heraklion, Greece today, Friday. In rugby, the Confederation of African Rugby Division 1B Africa Cup contest starts in Kampala, Uganda today, Friday. The week-long round-robin contest features Botswana, Ivory Coast, Mauritius, Madagascar, Senegal, and hosts Uganda. Turning to athletics, Africa's top female sprinters, Blessing Okagbare Igote Gwonor, along with Ivory Coast's Muriel Lahore and Marie-José Talou, compete in 100 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Paris, France. East Africa's long-distance rivalry comes alive in women's 5,000 meters, where Ethiopia's Almaz Ayana, Genzebe Dibaba, and Belianesh Oljira face Kenya's Mercy Cherono, Viola Jelagat Kibiwot, and Faith Chepngetich Kibiegon. Algerian Olympic champion Taufik Makloufi heads Africa's charge in men's 1,500 meters, which also features Ethiopian Aman Wote, Moroccan Abdelati Gida, and Djibouti's Ayanle Suleiman. Kenyan Eunice Sum competes in women's 800 meters as South Africans Wade Fanny Kirk and Wenda Nell compete in men's 400 meters and women's 400 meter hurdles respectively. Kenyans look to dominate the men's 3,000 meter steeplechase, where Olympic champion Ezekiel Kemboi faces Jairus Kipchoge Birech, Brimin Kipruto, Paul Kipsiele Koech, and Conseslus Kipruto. South Africans Kotso Mokwena and Sunet Fulyun contest the men's long jump and women's javelin respectively. In football, Liberia host Guinea in Monrovia in their Orange African Nations Championship qualifier on Sunday. It will be the first match played in Liberia since the lifting of the ban on football in the country as a measure to curb the spread of the Ebola virus. In other matches, Gambia host Senegal, Kenya play Ethiopia, and Angola face Swaziland. Elsewhere, Botswana play Lesotho, Burundi encounter Djibouti, Seychelles engage Mozambique, Zambia host Namibia, Comoro Islands challenge Zimbabwe, Uganda play Tanzania, Mauritius face South Africa, and Mali engage Guinea-Bissau. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
This is Africa. Zamina mina, waka waka, Zamina mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Ni chabulile. Hola.
Cause this is Africa. Zamina mina, waka waka, Zamina mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Hi. I'm Shegwa Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I got a tweet from Ruby, whose Twitter handle is @RubyR_3, and Ruby is a fan of both Hope Solo and the Seattle Reign. The club Solo plays for in the National Women's Soccer League. Regarding Hope's World Cup performance so far, Ruby says, "Yay, Hope Solo! She has been amazing leading the USA's defense. Still with the Women's World Cup, I appeared Thursday evening on Channels TV in Nigeria on the Sports Tonight Show hosted by Toyin Ibitoye. And my friend Toyin asked me to stick my neck out and make a prediction ahead of Sunday's final between the USA and Japan in Vancouver. My prediction, USA 3, Japan 1. And then Toyin's quick response, "Sonny, you were generous to give Japan a goal." Well, it's going to be interesting to see if Hope Solo and her rock-solid backline of Julie Johnston and Becky Sauerbrunn can stop the Japanese. History is on the side of the American women. They've played the Japanese 31 times and lost only once in the 2011 World Cup final in Frankfurt, Germany. The USA has won 24 times, and there have been 6 draws. Go USA! I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Woo-hee.
Go USA! Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a disturbing pattern of extrajudicial killings by Kenyan police. And next, Ethiopian students getting involved in politics. But for some music, here is George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival.
Bop! Bafana, Bafana, and Nelson Mandela.
Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival. On city streets, in towns and cities of Kenya, police are shooting and killing suspects almost every day. No arrest, no charges, no jail, no trial, no judge. VOA's Gabe Joslow investigates the case of one young man killed by police in Nairobi that reveals a disturbing pattern of extrajudicial killings by Kenyan police.
James Njenga is being buried at his rural homestead in Kiambu, a town just outside Nairobi. This is the second tragedy visited on the family within a month. Steps from his own grave lies the body of his 17-year-old son, Stephen Gachuru, who was gunned down by police in a Nairobi slum in May. Stephen's brother, Mwangi, says his father died from a broken heart. My father really loved Stephen because he was the first son who offered to come and stay with him in Kiambu. So losing that love is what has killed him. Stephen Gachuru's case highlights a troubling trend in Kenya. Young men killed by the police for petty crimes rather than being arrested or charged. A study by the nonprofit organization, the Independent Medico-Legal Unit, or IMLU, found more than 1,200 people were shot dead by police in Kenya in a period of just 5 years. By contrast, only 259 gun deaths were caused by armed robbers. Stephen Gachuru's life came to an end here in the Kiamaiko neighborhood, where crime and unemployment run rampant. Police say he started robbing and stealing. But there was another side to Stephen, the acrobat. Here he is in red, performing with a Kenyan troupe during a visit to Taiwan. His family says this was the real Stephen, not the thug the police said he was. His sister-in-law, Ruth Mumbi, a human rights defender who has led the charge on the case, says police pressure forced Stephen to leave the neighborhood.
He had left the community for a couple of months after he was threatened by the police. They forced him to move out of Kiamaiko, or rather, if he does not move, they are going to kill him because they had said there were some allegations that they were saying that he is among the criminal grouping.
But during a visit to pick up some electrical wires, he had his final run-in with the police.
But the police officers went ahead and said that we told you, we warned you that anywhere we are going to come across you, we are going to kill you, and today it's your day.
A police report said Stephen was involved in a robbery with two other men armed with machetes. The report says two plainclothes police officers confronted them and Stephen was shot dead. A stolen phone was recovered along with 3,000 Kenyan shillings, worth about $35. No weapons were found. An autopsy conducted by the nonprofit IMLU showed Stephen was shot three times and showed no signs of resistance. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Students have played a vital role in Ethiopia's political history for five decades. Martha Vanderwolf reports for VOA from Addis Ababa about how today's students are getting involved in politics.
Ethiopia's government just won another 5 years in power. The ruling party is often accused of not being democratic. But while former Ethiopian regimes face politically active student movements, Ethiopian students today appear less involved. Addis Ababa University law student Nathaniel agrees that his generation is not as active.
I do admire the sacrifice they've paid. And I think the reason why youth and students that are my contemporaries do not behave in this manner is because they don't have a point to rally behind. Right now, there's a divide between the youth. It could be from an ethnic point of view. It could be financial because of the difference between rich and poor. They can't set their differences aside to rally behind a point.
Besides the divisions, more students say they find it difficult to freely voice their opinion. They save political discussions for when they are in safe spaces with only close friends and family. Nathaniel, who did not want his last name used in this report, says it is implied there might be consequences of having a different opinion.
Voicing your opinions as maybe a fully fledged democratic state would have it, and voicing your opinions in this particular state might not be considered the same thing.
Economic student Menelik says today's students have no one else but themselves to blame for their passiveness, as they have now better access to information. But Menelik also believes the divisions keep today's students from being successfully organized.
If we had something to die for, like our ancestors had something to die for. They thought that if they die, there is somebody else carrying the torch who would take it to the finish line. They were 100% convinced about that. We are not united. If I die, I die. And close friends come to my funeral. That's it, and family. It ends there.
The former regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam was especially tough on students, forcing many to flee the country, go underground, or join armed movements. Ethiopia's current government came to power in 1991 after overthrowing the former regime. Students such as former Prime Minister Meles Zenawi led a 17-year guerrilla war. But before that, Ethiopia's last emperor, Haile Selassie, also had to deal with critical students protesting his policies. Yaacob Haile Mariam was the president of the National Union of Ethiopian University Students in 1966. He says that even though the emperor ran an absolute monarchy, students could still protest against issues such as land ownership.
The emperor was, he was very paternalistic, that there was no cruelty involved. And they looked at us really as misbehaving children, rather than, you know, somebody that is to be taken seriously in terms of their ideas and so on. So there were no large-scale imprisonment.
Yaacob wishes more students of the current generation were actively involved in their country's affairs, saying they are not as militant as his generation used to be. Students made up a large part of those who protested against the 2005 election results. But as expected, there were no student protests after the 2015 election results were announced. The ruling Ethiopia's People's Revolutionary Democratic Front and their affiliated parties won 546 out of 547 parliament seats. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Shuagan Chung, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Self-government, that is, a people exercising all the necessary functions of power without interference by a higher authority that they can't control themselves, is a core American value. It's also at the heart of the Declaration of Independence, which we celebrate today. Thomas Jefferson, the document's primary author, wrote that self-rule is the separate and equal station that a people are entitled to under the laws of God and nature. It didn't come easily. America's early history is marked by conflict with other countries threatened by Republican government and among Americans themselves over the ultimate form that that government would take. But the Declaration laid the framework for a nation that would endure and grow, inspiring similar independence movements around the world. When war first broke out between Britain and its North American colonists, few imagined, let alone supported, the creation of a new nation. Historians note that even as the fighting raged, the colonists were deeply divided over the future. Roughly a third came to believe a complete break with Britain was needed. A third remained loyal to the British crown, and a third simply wanted to be left alone to raise their families and do their jobs. The 56 men who signed the Declaration on July 4, 1776, cast the first votes for independence. Their fellow citizens ratified the choice, and with it the then radical principle that government should be based on the consent of the governed. While this is the event and cause we celebrate today, it isn't unique to Americans. It is embodied in the constitutions of many nations and observed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we all recognize. In essence, then, Independence Day is a celebration of our common humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
This
is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Kande Greaves. Its symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain. Within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.